Warriors, this is Andrew Marr, and today I wanted to talk to you guys about the book that we have coming out later this fall called Tales from the Blast Factory, and it's about my trial, my family's trial and experiences with the symptoms of traumatic brain injury, and then what it takes to pull yourself out of that and live a life of purpose and fulfillment. And why do TBIs matter? Well, they matter because close to 400,000 individuals have been diagnosed with a traumatic brain injury in the military since 2000 to 2015. Of that, up to 50% of those will develop a major mental disorder after diagnosis. And the conventional model has been psychotherapy and medication, which in most cases further exacerbates the problem. And it does that because it doesn't treat the underlying condition. And that's the basis of the book. We wanted to show what that life looks like, the life of an operator, what happens when disaster strikes and you step into the unknown and everything that you once knew is not the way it is anymore. And then we wanted to talk about and show the process of that healing process and talk about the Warrior Angels Foundation. And since then, we've brought that same level of healing that I've received to hundreds of others while delivering our message of hope and a viable solution to millions. And it was thinking, visualizing, and believing it in our minds first brought it into existence. And we wrote this book, my brother and I, Adam, so others could do the same thing. The name of the book is Tales from the Blast Factory. You can sign up to get on the pre-launch list. It'll get you all kinds of cool Warrior Soul bennies at www.talesfromtheblastfactory.com, and you can also pre-order on Amazon.com. That's Tales from the Blast Factory. You can pre-order on Amazon.com and talesfromtheblastfactory.com.
Hey guys, it's Chris here, and I just want to tell you about our new sponsors. You know, one of the things that I've always talking about here on this podcast and on the Warrior Soul Goji YouTube channel are the benefits of ketosis and the benefits of including healthy fats in your diet. They help to protect your brain. They help to reduce total body chronic inflammation. And honestly, I can say this with confidence, including fat in my diet has made me a better person. Why? Because it's given me lasting energy. I can go throughout the day. I don't get hangry. I don't get moody because I haven't eaten, and I'm able to feel better and perform better because of the fats I include in my diet. Now, one of the problems, and I completely understand this, is that a lot of people don't have access to fats in their daily lives. You know, when I was in the Marine Corps and I was out in the field, there was very little possibility that I was ever going to have access to something like coconut oil or avocado oil or macadamia nut oil. Well, when I went to Paleo FX this year, I ran into some really good people from F-Bomb Fuel. And what they've done is they've put together individualized packets of good, healthy, and delicious fats. They've got avocado oil, macadamia nut oil, MCT oil, coconut oil. On top of that, they've got some really delicious nut butters. Their macadamia nut butter is absolutely amazing. I've never really tasted anything like it. And it all comes in this extremely portable packet that you can take with you anywhere. They've also got some portable salad oils that you can take with you as well. If you're eating a salad, you can pour them on top of those, or you can pour them over your food. These are a lifesaver for anybody who wants to live a healthy, fat-adapted lifestyle. And the best part is that the company is run by some really good people. They have a really strong desire to do good, and they've got a really strong desire to help out veterans. And we're working on some things for the future where they're going to be able to do that. So if you want to check this stuff out, and I promise you, if you try this macadamia nut butter or any of their other products, you're not going to be disappointed. Check them out at www.fatissmartfuel.com. You know, over the last few years, I've put a concerted effort into trying to become a better person. I don't drink anymore. I don't smoke anymore. I don't womanize anymore. I've been in a dedicated relationship for a while now. I work out every chance I get. I try to push myself physically. I hit the weights. I run. I do jiu-jitsu. But one area of my life that I've consistently been lax on, and this has been true my whole life, is sleep. You know, I've constantly burnt the candle at both ends. And I thought that I was a better person for it. Now, one thing that I've started to realize recently is that despite the effort that I put in, despite all of the exercise I put in, and despite the good diet, you know, getting the healthy fats in and everything like that, when I don't sleep, I miss things. You know, and maybe I'm able to get stuff done, but it's not my best. I'm not giving 100% at that time. I'm just getting things done to get them done. And it's hurt me. And it's hurt not only me, it's hurt this business. It's hurt this show. It's hurt my relationship with my woman. And it's kind of opposite of everything I've ever been taught at any point in my life. And it's probably the opposite of everything you've been taught. You know, I used to think that if you get 8 hours of sleep a night, you're not doing what you need to do. You're not pushing everything. You're not putting everything into your life. You're not putting everything into your business, your job, whatever it is. Now, there's a lot of us who served in the military and who are still serving in the military who think this way too. But I'm starting to realize the cost. You know, it's a day of not feeling your best here. It's a missed opportunity there. It's not giving 100% on something that is potentially important, you know, and I'm putting a concerted effort now, maybe I didn't get enough sleep last night, but I'm putting a concerted effort now to try to get 8 hours of sleep, especially after listening to our guest from today's episode, and that's Dr. Kirk Parsley. Dr. Parsley served in two professions where sleep is pretty much scarce. He was a Navy SEAL, and he served for 15 years. And he's a physician. And yeah, I don't know if you know much about physicians, but you know, as they're going through their residencies, they are consistently sleep deprived. But he taught me some really interesting things. You know, if you don't sleep if you miss a couple hours of sleep, like say you get 6 hours of sleep a night for a week, that's the equivalent of having a blood alcohol content of 0.8 to 0.10. Legally drunk. It's absolutely insane how much we deprive ourselves of sleep. And because of that, how much we are depriving ourselves of life, health, and productivity. So I'm going to stop yapping my trap here, and I'm going to let you get it straight from the expert. And now let's get into this episode with Dr. Kirk Parsley. This is Chris Albert, and I'm here to remind you of one thing. Someday, you're going to die. Now that's not some morbid statement or scary idea. It's a solid fact. Your time here on this earth is limited. And you need to be reminded of this as much as possible for one simple reason. To live your best life while you can. This is the Warrior Soul Podcast.
Hey
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Warrior Soul Podcast. I'm over here with my brother, Andrew. And today we are absolutely privileged to have an amazing person on this podcast, Dr. Kirk Parsley. Dr. Parsley is a medically retired. Are you medically retired, sir?
No, just did my time and left, man. 19 okay. years.
retired Navy SEAL, medical doctor, and a sleep expert. He has an amazing TED Talk. And this is going to be a fascinating podcast for me because I'm one of these guys who was surviving off of 4 or 5 hours of sleep, and I thought I was going to be all right. But I've realized over the years that I've been doing this that cognitively there's certain things that I'm missing. I'll get interrupted in my sentences. I'll be a little bit slower later in the day. And, you know, as somebody who suffers from an autoimmune disease, ulcerative colitis, I'm constantly worried about things that are going to shut my body down. So Dr. Parsley, first off, thank you so much for coming on.
Hey man, it's my pleasure. Great organization. And I'm proud to be a part of it. And for you guys, let me on is a privilege. So thanks.
We just mentioned a little bit about your background, but can you talk about, you know, how you decided on joining the Navy SEALs and then maybe how you decided on becoming a doctor and how you became interested in sleep?
Yeah, sure. I could eat up 2 hours with that, but I'll give you guys the Reader's Digest version. I'm sure audience would want to hear it all. But I was actually, back in the day, you know, spec war was a considerably different crowd than it is now before they sort of had any, fanfare and public image. And, I was a pretty high level competing athlete most of my life. Played football, did track and field, did a lot of martial arts, and that was kind of my outlet. I was a terrible student. I liked racing cars. I liked chasing girls. I liked sports. I didn't care about school at all. So, the time came for me to leave high school 4 years after I started, I was still a sophomore. Most people didn't know that, but, I had negotiated about 3 or 4 months before to go get my GED and join the military. I wanted to be a SEAL, ostensibly from what I'd seen on TV and movies, it was the toughest training in the world. And I wanted to be the toughest guy in the world. So, hey, it made sense. And I, dropped out of high school, essentially went, got my GED, went to the SEAL teams, had a great experience there. But as the saying goes, I met a girl and, things changed and, plus I was in during the Clinton administration, which was kind of a boring time to be in spec war, a lot of police action, not really anything, that you trained to do, not anything super exciting. I kind of felt like it was a young single man's job and I was becoming neither. And so decided I'd move on and, actually got out, started going to college, thought I was going to be a physical therapist, started working at San Diego Sports Medicine Center as a physical therapy aide, moved up to a physical therapy assistant while I was there, got married, had kids, all that. And then when I was, and then the doctors I worked there with, they talked me into becoming a doctor. It's pretty soon after I started working there, I figured I didn't really want to be a physical therapist. It was a little too limited for me. These guys talked me into being a doctor, which I thought it was like the dumbest idea ever. I'm like, dude, you realize I'm a high school dropout and like I barely passed the GED. I didn't even pass that with flying colors. But so started looking in medical schools. Literally, this is pre-internet, so you go to the bookstore, you check out Kaplan's books, and you look to see, what GPAs and MCAT scores would make you competitive to which schools. And that's when I found out the military had their own medical school. And I was like, all right, so they're going to pay me to go to medical school instead of me paying somebody else. And, I knew the game of the commitment, you give a little, they make you pay it back. And, it was worth it to me. So I figured I'd get back to the SEAL teams as their physician, and you know that was exciting to me. You know, I figured it wouldn't change my medical career that much to go through medical school, but it sure would be easier on my family. So got back to the SEAL teams at like a very fortuitous time. As you guys know, every initiative that they start out, you know, that they start takes about, you know, 10 years to actually happen. And so I got there just at the time when all the funding and the reality of building our first sports medicine facility was a reality. And so they put me in charge of building that clinic, and I got to, you know, supervise the build out of it. Of course, I had a great background in that, and I got to participate in hiring all of the people that we needed, our first nutritionist, our first strength.
Still on the West Coast, right, Kirk?
Yeah, this is the West Coast guys exclusively. Yeah. The East Coast guys already had a facility for maybe a year and a half before this. So I got to hire our first nutritionist, our first strength and conditioning coach, our first athletic trainer, our first, you know, exercise physiologist, our first PT, and then started bringing pain rounds through and ortho rounds through. And then I was the dumbest guy around. So we've all been in the military. What does the dumbest guy do? Supervise. So they put me in charge of the facility. And so what would happen, because my office was in this rehab gym. I mean, you guys know the gig with Spec War, or SOF is, people, they go in to do their physicals or their annual checkups or whatever the Navy or Army or Marines or whatever says they have to do, they go do it. But they just flat out lie, right? They check out, no, nothing's ever happened to me. I've never felt sore, sick, or nauseous, or dizzy, or anything. And because they don't want to be disqualified, right? But what would happen is, I'd been a SEAL recently enough to where they were still, probably 40, 50 SEALs there, and around the teams that I'd been a SEAL with. So, they'd come in and close the door and say, "Hey man, can I talk to you about something?" And they'd tell me what's really going on with them. And they were having a bunch of symptoms that I wasn't really quite sure what to make of. But it wasn't disease. And unfortunately, I'm a medical doctor, and what medical doctors get trained in is how to recognize and diagnose and manage disease. And they were coming to me and saying, I'm just not quite me. It takes me 5 times leaving my house before I'm actually on my way to work. And then I usually miss one of the exits on my way to work. And, it takes me 3 hours to send an email that used to take 15 minutes. I feel emotional. I'm short with my wife. I'm short with my kids. My body composition shifting. I work out harder than I ever have. My diet's cleaner. My workout routine is smart, and I'm doing everything right. And I'm just getting worse and, feel like crap. And, give me a hand. Let me know what's going on. And I'm sitting there going, shit, I don't know. That's not disease. I mean, it's all, sub disease. So, I mean, they weren't depressed, but they had a lower mood. They didn't have they didn't have an anxiety disorder, but, had more anxiety than they would have ordinarily had. There was, just a bunch of shifts and stuff. And, like I said, I'm a high school dropout, so I'm not the smartest guy around. And about 100 patients into this, it just kind of clicked in my head. I'm like, I think every single person I've talked to has told me they take Ambien every night. So I went back through my records, and sure enough, every one of them had said that. I'd initially thought, this was 2009. So I'd initially thought, 8 years of combat, this could be adrenal fatigue. So learned a lot. Are you guys still there?
Yep.
All right. Everything got quiet. Thought maybe you dropped off. So I learned a lot about adrenal fatigue, studied, of course, the beauty of my job being the West Coast SEAL doc, I could call up other professionals and just, tell them, "Hey, I love your TED talk. I love your book. I love whatever, could I come train with you? Could I consult with you?" and all that. So I thought, you know, maybe this is adrenal fatigue. I worked pretty hard on that theory for a while, had some success with it. I wouldn't call it great, maybe 30-40% success with that. And then this whole sleeping idea came up, and I knew nothing about sleep. And if, you know, unless you're talking to a physician who specializes in sleep, he doesn't know any, he or she doesn't know anything about sleep either, because I didn't have a single class on sleep in medical school. And, so I had to go back to college level kind of textbooks and figure out, all right, well, what is sleep? Like what goes on with you, you know, when you sleep, and what doesn't go on when you don't sleep? And, you know, pretty quickly kind of, through educating myself, maybe over a few months of reading and talking to some people, I was like, man, just about every single symptom that these guys are complaining of could be explained by sleep. And then of course you guys know Mark Gordon, and, probably about a year after I was dead set that sleep was it, and sleep was everything. And that was all the problems. And we can talk about what I did and sort of the success rate I had, in treating those guys, which was, you know, really astonishing. I had amazing turnarounds with these guys, just focusing on their sleep and getting them off of sleep drugs. But, about a year and a half after I'd started doing that, I went to a conference where Mark Gordon was lecturing on TBI, and I had a few guys that I knew had TBI, and I'm like, well, you know, let me go see what this guy has to say about TBI and see if there's anything I can add to help my dudes out. And so I went to his lecture, and he starts throwing up his case reports, and he starts throwing up his labs, which are really close to the labs I draw. And the labs look almost identical, and the symptoms look almost identical. And then I'm like, crap, maybe this is all TBI. So then I, you know, sort of started integrating those two, and, I learned a lot from Mark, did some studying on my own, trained under some other guys. And I'm like, at this point, I don't really care. I don't care if it's adrenal fatigue. I don't care if it's, chaotic or sleep, or chronic sleep deprivation, or TBI, or CTE, or whatever the hell acronym you want to throw out there. The beauty of it is that the treatment for all of it, the stuff that seems to make guys get better, there's about a dozen things that seem to really work. Those work regardless of what the diagnosis is. So, you know, the point is to get guys back to optimal health and optimal performance. And so that's what I focused on for years. Got in a lot of trouble for it because it was, you know, non-traditional stuff. It was non-standard of care. Navy didn't like me doing it. Got out, kept doing it. guys kept calling me, and, you know, now of course the way the game unfolds always is, you know, now they pay me to come and teach their physicians to do the stuff they wouldn't allow me to do when I was there. You know, so.
Well, I got a question about setting up this center that you had. It seems like over the last like 10 to 15 years, things have really changed as far as what we know about nutrition, what we know about resilience, and how different things lead to resilience. Did you have to go through like several different iterations of staff members in creating this? Because a lot of the nutritionists, the trainers, the people in the medical community, I know they're not willing to go down this non-traditional route.
Yeah. And yeah, unfortunately that is true. Despite the fact that we brought in just some, I mean, just flat out amazing people. I mean, some of the people that we managed to snag from professional sports teams and the Olympic training center and stuff. I was in awe that the people that were willing to come work with us and oftentimes for a pay cut. And I was like, just like, man, this is a great group of people. But you know, the way the military works, I mean, you get new leadership in, priorities change, and all of a sudden there's not that much funding, and these guys are on continuing resolution, and they're having to get side jobs to make ends meet, and then that guy leaves, and then another guy leaves, and so that's changed quite a bit. And unfortunately, I'd been around long enough to know that was going to happen. And what I've been proposing for, geez, I don't, I'd say probably, 6 or 7 years is a standalone facility, and we've got lots of people that are willing to fund it. There's so many philanthropic organizations that are willing to fund it, you know, to fund the testing of it. But what we really need, the only true solution, is we have to get away from standard care, right? We have to get away from standardized care. And this a very simple metaphor is the computers in the military, right? So what type of computers do you get in the military? They're crap, right? And the reason they're crap is because by the time the military goes through all of the steps needed to actually buy that computer, it's 10 years old. It's 10 years out of date, man. It's not like it's a worthless piece of plastic by the time they install it. And the medical system is the same way. I mean, we are dealing with, if you think about it, we are dealing with the first time in history that we have all of this amazing equipment that is way, that is able to, is way more dynamic and is able to withstand way more than the organism inside the equipment, right? Like the person, that part that we're actually trying to protect, that can't handle all the crap that the equipment can handle around it. So we're breaking people at a rate and in a way that's never happened before. And that's, you know, it's only going to get worse as equipment keeps getting better. And so that what that requires, I mean, you think about it, every time you get an advancement in a weapon system, how often does that happen? I mean, right? I mean, that stuff happens every day, every few months, every year at least. Like there's some big advancement in a weapon system, but we think we can just keep giving people Motrin and treating them like we did in the 50s.
And too, Kirk, when you look at the maintenance, especially with you're talking about military equipment, how much time and effort is put into maintaining equipment? And we're just saying, hey, do the same thing for the human body if humans are more important than hardware. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And we all know the truth, right? I mean, it's like, it's great. It's great that we get, higher resolution nods with some depth perception capabilities or, better vehicles, better body armor, like all that stuff's great, man. I love it. But we also know the fact that what wins the combats are the guys, right? It's the training of the guys. It's the it's the type of guys we get into the system. It's the intensity that they train with. It's the frequency that they train with. And it's how much money we put into training them. And that seems to be, very well understood by the leadership of the military. What seems to be completely disconnected is the fact that you actually need to maintain that. I mean, think of a special forces guys like an F1 car, right? This is a Formula One car. And the military is trying to do, a maintenance schedule and, treat it like it's a Honda Accord or something, like it doesn't work. Like these are highly specialized machines that need different treatment. They need different maintenance schedules. And what's going to require is just an open mind. I'm not saying that, we need to, be dropping LSD on active duty, military guys or something like that. But what I am saying is that we need a modular system. We need a system that is approved by the DOD and that will send the DOD or like, even if it's not DOD, whatever level we could get, SOCOM level approval to send guys through these places. And we make them modular, right? So you have this MRT, this magnet that seems to be really helping people with TBIs. As long as that works, keep it in. When something else comes better, that goes away and something else comes in. Transcranial ultrasound seems to help some people. We put that in there. If that's outperformed by something else, we move it on, right? We do the same thing with equipment. As soon as we get a superior piece of equipment, we get rid of that. The system needs to be modular, needs to be DOD approved, but it can't be run by DOD or we're going to run into the same problems we do with the computers.
Yeah, it just seems to me there's so many obstacles. You spoke about Dr. Gordon and what he's found regarding hormones. And it just seems to me that there's so many obstacles to allowing active duty troops to get the hormonal therapy they need, to get the hormone replenishment that they need. And it's insane because I guess up until a couple of days ago based on a tweet. You know, you were able to get that kind of treatment to be transgendered, but you weren't able to get that kind of treatment to feel normal.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, what's more asinine about it is, you know, the first concept that everybody needs to know is that we don't know shit about the human body, right? It's like we understand about 2/5 of 1% of what's going on in the body. It's so much more complex than we want to pretend like it is. But there's all these political and social prejudice against all sorts of things, right? I mean, the social examples are legion, right? Marijuana wasn't even outlawed for marijuana. Marijuana was outlawed for hemp because they didn't want hemp competing with DuPont's nylon ropes. I mean, that's how marijuana became an illegal substance. Sex hormones became steroids. They became anabolic steroids, and they had this, connotation that they were used by idiot bodybuilders. Or they're used, by professional athletes to cheat in sports. Well, guess what, man? Those damn things exist in every mammal on the planet. They exist in our body, and they were higher when we were younger, and they're lower when we're older, and they're lower when we're sleep deprived, and they're lower when we're injured, and they're lower when we're depressed, and they're lower when we're stressed. And those things have a lot to do with our performance. But they're sex hormone, and it's a specific type of sex hormone. I mean, you could give men all the estrogen you wanted. Nobody would freak out about it, but you give them testosterone, that'll freak them out. You
can get and I were saying that, and I think there's a joke Andrew came up with, if genders are this amorphous thing that can be malleable, what if you went up to the military and said, hey, I want to be super manly alpha performing man?
Yeah. We got to get the millennials to start identifying with some kind of uber human species.
Yeah, right.
Even take it away from that. I mean, what if your insulin levels were too low? Would we treat that? Of course, right? What if your thyroid was too low? Would we treat that? Of course. Like, what if, any of the hundreds of hormones in your body, if those things were off, no problem treating them. But that's testosterone. People use that to hit home runs illegally or get bigger muscles, and that makes it bad. It's the dumbest. I mean, it's completely nonsensical. I mean, it's completely nonsensical. It would be,
think of it like this. Go ahead, Kirk.
If you came into my office and I tested you for mineral or vitamin deficiencies, right? And I came back and I'm like, you're deficient in these 7 vitamins. I'm going to give you these 7 vitamins in a supplement, except B12, because that's really controversial and people use that to cheat in sports. So you can't have that one. Like, everybody, like, who would think that's a reasonable idea? But that's exactly what we do with hormones.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's like we're going to outlaw people from getting up early because that gives them an edge on the competition. It just never made any sense to me. But, talking about the no sleep mindset and soft, we're trained to be able to function without sleep. And those type of individuals specifically have shown to be mentally tougher. So how does that transition into regular life when now maybe somebody gets out of the military and they're running a business or they're living life, they're trying to perform at an optimal level, and they're still operating, on 3 to 5 hours of sleep a night? How long can that go on before starts causing real detriment to the body and their performance and overall well-being?
Yeah, so I mean that's the unfortunate. There's some unfortunate aspects of that, but I mean, as you mentioned, the military itself is replete with all sorts of really sophisticated psychological manipulation in it, and that's how that's how the military changes people's lives in 12 weeks. One of the examples of that, of course, is special forces. And one of the things that, the military does in general is that they sleep deprive people, because we know that sleep depriving people who have a propensity or proclivity for, or sort of genetic sort of risk factors for psychiatric disease are more likely to exhibit that psychiatric disease if they're sleep deprived. So that's one of the reasons boot camp sleep deprives people, because we want to get rid of anybody in that environment. And then, you know, special forces take that to another level. And then special forces take that even to a higher level, is that we want to see who can actually perform really well when they're sleep deprived. That oftentimes gets confused with this concept that these people aren't affected by it, right? So, you know, when we were chatting before the show, we talked about Jocko, you know, Jocko's 430 club, and Jocko's a dear friend of mine. I love the guy to death. I respect the hell out of him. You know, but he, you know, he's got these people who are, you know, set on one mindset, and they're set on a certain set of goals, and so they're doing these things. And I got no problem with that. I mean, there's seasons in life. As long as you're treating everything seasonally and you're not saying, I'm going to do this for the rest of my life, yeah, sure, go for it. Beat yourself down. Like, we've all beaten ourselves down, right? The military beat the hell out of us for a while. We came out of it, you know, more resilient, stronger, whatever. I mean, there's benefits to all of that. But what needs to be clear to people is that there has never been any research at any point in any walk of life in any country under any scientific body that I'm aware of that showed that anybody performs as well without adequate sleep as they perform with adequate sleep. So, you know, an article came out a couple of years ago about this genetic variant of these super sleepers, and I got just inundated with these emails and texts and tweets and all this, like, ha ha, here you go. Like, here's the proof that not everybody needs the same amount of sleep. Not true at all. I mean, what it didn't show that anybody could get away with less sleep. What it showed is that not everybody suffers to the same extent, which should be obvious, right? I mean, if you are, you know, let's take ultra marathons. If I were able to run one ultra marathon, it would probably be the end of me. Like, you know, it'd take everything I ever had to be able to get through there. I'm not built for ultra marathons. My body composition isn't made for it. My muscle fibers aren't right. My body size, my mechanics, all of that sucks for that. But, you know, there are little dudes who can run ultra marathons all day. And there's reasonably sized guys. I mean, you know, David Goggins, I'm reasonably big, you know, pretty big dude. There are people who can do that. But does that mean it's good for him? Absolutely not. I mean, it's still destroying his body. He's still breaking himself down. He's just not breaking down as fast as I would. And so what happens when we get this military mindset, we go in and we do our, you know, we do our military work, we do our spec op work, it, you know, makes it even worse. And we start drinking our own Kool-Aid and we start thinking, you know, we're invincible. Like, we can just push through it. You know, I've done this before. And it's true. We have done it before, but every time you do it, it gets a little harder and it gets a little harder to recover. And you add that to, you know, some aging, some metabolic shifts, some, you know, gut biome shifts, some hormonal shifts, some extra stress, you know, having kids, having a wife, you know, all that type of stuff starts eating into your ability to be resilient. And if you think that you can just keep doing that because you could do it when you're 20, you know, it's as silly as, you know, an 80-year-old man doing keg stands. I mean, it's as same type of mentality. You just can't be done forever. It can't be sustained forever.
Yeah. One of my problems here is that, I really love getting up very early in the morning. Like, I love being up at 4 a.m. and I think Jocko talks about this too. It's kind of like the opportunity cost, right? So he'd rather have that time than not have that time. And for me, that's what's been the problem, because my girlfriend doesn't get home till 11 p.m. and then I still want to get up at 4 a.m. to try to get everything done early. And, you know, just lately I'd been feeling really eaten up. You know, my mental capacity is a little bit lower. I find myself getting frustrated easier. I find myself getting anxiety attacks. And, you know, I'm in remission from ulcerative colitis now, but I'm always constantly worried that my autoimmunity is going to come back and kind of take over, which it has in the past. Yeah. But you talk about this putting faith in kind of a gamble in your TEDx talk. What should somebody like me do? Is it really just putting your faith into it and seeing what you can do?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the reality that nobody wants to hear. I mean, I lecture all over the world, all different bodies, you know, all different, you know, types of organizations. And one of the things that they're really, you know, I'd say comes up just about every lecture, you know, every time I lecture, especially any first responders or law enforcement, you know, the questions that come up at the end, you know, is they want me to tell them that 2 + 2 doesn't equal 4, that they can do shift work and be healthy. Well, you can't. Like, you just can't. You can't sleep deprive yourself and be healthy. You can't sleep. You can't sleep off of your circadian rhythm and be healthy. Does that mean that you can't survive it? Absolutely not. But it's no different than saying, you know, we all used to hear this adage all the time, right? It's like, well, my grandfather smoked 2 packs a day for 20 years and 50 years, and he didn't die of lung cancer. So obviously, right? I mean, that's the logic. And that we're doing the same thing with sleep. It's like, can you function? Can you get through stuff? Yeah, you can. For sure. And if you're really determined and you're pushing yourself really hard, you can do probably a pretty decent job of it. Does that make it a good idea? Probably not. I mean, it might make it a good idea for a specific project, for a specific focus, you know, for a specific amount of time. But if you want to be the best you that you can be, there is absolutely nothing in the world. There's not a single modality. There's not a single drug. There's not a single nutritional supplement or drink or shake or program that you can find that's more beneficial than sleep. And there's also nothing that's going to break you faster than sleep deprivation. That is the number one thing. That's like, you can eat like crap for 20 years or sleep like crap for 20 years, I guarantee you, you're going to be way worse off by sleeping like crap. You know, there's a reason we use sleep deprivation as sort of a torture technique, as a way to get people to talk, right? It breaks you down, and it breaks you down quick, man. And for you, like somebody with autoimmunity, guess when your immune system restores? Stages 3 and 4 of sleep, man. Like, that's when it's happening. That's the only time your immune system is getting better. That's the only time you're truly repairing, is when you're sleeping. You know, when you exercise, you don't get stronger. We all know that, right? When you lift, say, like, if you want to be strong, you want to be enduring, doesn't matter. But, you know, we'll use strength as a simple example. You want to be able to lift more weights. You lift more weight than your body can lift. What does that do? It damages your muscles. It tears them down. It breaks them down. Cells literally rupture. They bleed, you know, enzymes into your blood that we can measure and say, you've done this much damage to your muscle tissue. When those muscle tissues repair, though, they repair a little stronger, a little thicker, a little more resilient, a little more able to produce a little more force. And then the next time you do that same amount of work or a little bit more, you can do a little bit more. And that's how you get stronger. That's true with every single thing. That's true with your memory. That's true with trying to learn something. That's true with trying to create something. It doesn't matter. The only time you're getting better at anything is while you're sleeping. You're always getting worse while you're awake. If I taught you how to play the piano at 8 o'clock in the morning, gave you, you know, 2-hour piano lesson, and then said, I want you to come back at 6 o'clock tonight and I'm going to see how much you remember. You're going to remember less than you remembered when you left. Okay. You're going to be worse off than after your lesson. Once you go home and go to sleep, however, though, you're going to come back about the same as you left that morning before, or maybe a little bit better. So you actually, by going to sleep, you actually learned something that you wouldn't have learned if you hadn't slept. You can add another layer to that and put a nap in between that and say, I'm going to teach you a piano lesson from, you know, 10 a.m. to noon. And then I'm going to have you take a nap, 3 hours later, and then come back 3 hours after that. And we're going to do a test, and you'll perform better than you left your morning lesson. And then you go home and go to sleep that night, and you'll perform better than you left your evening lesson, and you learn twice as fast. I've done this with some mixed martial arts guys, you know, who are trying to really buff up on, you know, one component of their game that is, you know, isn't their strong suit, and they're trying to learn a lot of skills really fast. Sleep is it. And if you think about it, and if you've, I mean, you alluded to my TED talk, if you listen to my TED talk, I mean, I can't say that it's a fact. It's a philosophical argument, but it's a pretty damn strong one in my mind that, you know, being asleep for a human being, you know, modern day, not a big deal, but, you know, just 100 years ago, 200 years ago, definitely 2000 years ago, very dangerous place, very vulnerable place to be. If we could have evolved to sleep less, would have made sense to do it. And the people who slept less would have been, you know, would have been rewarded by, you know, longer lives and, you know, better performance and all that other stuff. And we would, and maybe we did, right? Maybe humans used to sleep 16 hours and we evolved like down to the minimum was 8. But, you know, so far there's no evidence that anybody does better with anything significantly less than 8 hours of sleep.
Kirk, what do you recommend or what's been shown to be useful for somebody to kind of downshift out of the sympathetic mode into the parasympathetic and be able to actually go into sleep? Because I know that's probably a big problem for a lot of people and probably a lot of people you come across say, I just can't fall asleep. So what's your recommendations there?
Yeah, I mean, like anything else, it's complex. There's a lot of variables involved. For men, one of the best things to do is just to exercise. And the reason for that is that what causes sleep pressure, and by sleep pressure, that's a medical term, but it's pretty aligned with what it sounds like intuitively. It's that drive when you lay down in bed, it's that drive that's just like pushing you to sleep. It's like, I'm done for the day. I'm going to sleep. That mental drive we call sleep pressure, and that's what's and what drives that is a chemical called adenosine. So it's some sort of, you know, basic physiology is essentially all the energy that our cells use to do what they do, regardless of what type of cell it is. They use something called ATP, and ATP gets broken down into ADP and AMP, and then eventually it gets broken down into just A, which is adenosine. So one of the reasons that men have less trouble falling asleep than women is because we have more muscle mass and approximately the same size brain. So we can build up a lot. We just have a lot more lean mass. Like, we have bigger lungs, we have bigger livers, we have bigger everything, right? Men are just bigger than women, but the brain size isn't that much difference. You know, pretty small difference in the brain size. So we build up this adenosine. We go to sleep pretty easily. Now, if the man's really stressed out, as soon as the adenosine goes away and the sleep pressure gets cleared, that they tend to wake up in the middle of the night. Women have a harder time falling asleep. But, you know, to your point, you know, what can we do to balance the autonomics? And for your listeners who don't know, I mean, just think of autonomic nervous system as your automatic nervous system, right? It's doing everything that you aren't thinking about. It's keeping you balanced. It's keeping you standing upright when you're standing in one spot. It's keeping your eyes tracking. It's keeping your heart rate. It's keeping your blood pressure. It's keeping, you know, muscular tension. It's keeping all sorts of things going on in your body, liver functions, you know, your immune function. All that stuff is to some degree being regulated by this automatic nervous system. And we have one side of it that's a very stressful response. And when we max that out, we call that the fight or flight system, right? That's the maximum sort of sympathetic. And then maximum parasympathetic is actually deep sleep, stages 3 and 4 of sleep. Sometimes the parasympathetic is called rest and digest. So, you know, fight or flight is one side of it, rest and digest is the other. And so those have to be balanced. Well, what balances those? Just about anything you can think of, right? One of the reasons people overeat so much is if you overeat, you eat a bunch of food, that weighs heavily in your digestive system. I just told you it's a rest and digest system. So you start, it starts stimulating your parasympathetics. You can do that through breathing exercises. You can do that through meditation. You can do that through progressive muscle relaxation. You can do that with the M wave. You can do that with heart rate variability training. You can do that with yoga. You can do that with all sorts of things. You can increase your parasympathetic tone. You can get rid of sympathetic tone by increasing parasympathetic tone, but you can also get rid of, you can also get rid of the stress or sympathetic tone by decreasing stimulants and decreasing stimulation, right? There's a reason those words sound a lot alike, because they're really the same thing. So if you're, you know, if your brain is wired and scared and anxious about something, it's not that much different than drinking caffeine all day. It has very similar effects on your brain and your body. That's one half of what we call sleep hygiene. Your audience may or may not have heard of sleep hygiene. What I always tell people, I try to explain it conceptually. So what is sleep hygiene? Well, think about a 3 or 4 year old kid. You know, do you let a 3 or 4 year old kid just run wild and bang on drums and, you know, play with stuff and watch television, whatever, and then just pick them up and put them in a bed and turn the light off and walk out of the room? No, that wouldn't work. We all know it wouldn't work. Why? They need time to settle down. We got to relax their nervous system. They got to quit interacting with their environment. They need a bedtime routine. They got to slow down. That's what that parasympathetic and sympathetic balance is. That's half of the sleep hygiene. The other half of the sleep hygiene is getting rid of the light, the photoperiod, what the blue light that goes in our eyes that stimulates our brain to tell our brain that it's daylight and it's time to be awake. And so that's what all the glasses are about, and the computer apps and the new, you know, the new phone apps and whatever that take the blue light out of your screen. So it's really just those two components.
You mentioned exercise. Is there a particular kind of exercise that people should do? And is there a particular time of day they should do it to keep their circadian rhythm in order?
Well, I mean, that can get complex because it depends on what you're trying to do. So if you want everything to be very regular, you know, let's say, you know, you're regular Joe, you live in the suburbs, you work 9 to 5, you do the same thing every day, and you know, you're going to plug along in this pathway for 30 or 40 years, whatever. That's a different thing than somebody who travels a lot or a professional athlete who, you know, is traveling for games and having to, you know, do some practices in the morning, some in the evening, whatever. But, I use exercise as a tool. So, daily exercise, and by that I don't necessarily mean lifting weights or running, whatever. By that I just mean being active enough to get some sweat going and to get a little bit of mobility work. I mean, you could clean your house vigorously enough to get, you know, to qualify as exercise in my book if you're just talking about being active enough to be healthy. If you have performance goals, you need to work towards that sport and whatever it's going to drive performance in that realm. You know, the exercise I recommend is the exercise that people will actually do. But you can place exercise. So, we talked about a little bit about circadian rhythms, and I don't want to get too geeky and down in the weeds with that, but you know, basically we evolved on this planet to use the sun as our cue to know when to be asleep and when to be awake. And then every time we travel or every time we, you know, just defy that through artificial light, shift work, like military jobs, like whatever we want, you know, for whatever reason, we defy that. We have to figure out ways to compensate for that. So you can use exercise as a way to compensate for that. So as an example, if I've traveled and I know I'm going to feel like falling asleep 2 or 3 hours before I should fall asleep, if I want to be on schedule with my new environment, then I would put my exercise really late in the day. Because if I put my exercise really late in the day, it's going to push my desire to go to sleep back 2 to 3 hours. And that's going to help me get on track. If the opposite is true, then I want to work out really early in the morning. I want to stimulate my body when my body isn't actually ordinarily stimulated. I want to increase that sympathetic tone earlier than it would have. I want to increase that adrenal function earlier than it would have happened if I didn't exercise. And so I'd place that in the morning. However, if we're just talking about simple Joe living in the suburbs, doing the same thing every day, all the time, it doesn't matter that much as long as it's a fairly regular activity. Now, if you're looking for performance, physical performance tends to correlate pretty well to peak body temperature, which is somewhere around noon, between noon and 2 p.m. So if you're looking to, perform the best during your exercise, whether it's strength or endurance, that, kind of that's your ideal window for that.
How about sex? You get all sweaty during that too.
Yeah. Well, sex has benefits all around.
Score.
Yeah. There's the physical aspect of that, which is a form of exercise. There's also, a lot of neurochemistry that changes during that. And a lot of that neurochemistry drives towards sleep. Or at least it was meant to evolutionarily. I think it still works on men. The postulate is that, if you have sex and, of course, the idea behind sex and mammals is to reproduce. So if you have sex, you're trying to impregnate the woman. So after you have sex, you should leave her alone and give your sperm a chance to reach the egg. So it tends to work really well for men to fall asleep, but over, a few hundred years, maybe there's been some shifts in DNA and evolution and social expectations where I think it now makes women want to talk. it's supposed to make them want to sleep as well. There's definitely some good chemical changes that go on in the brain.
I got to ask this just because I know there's a buttload of Marines who listen to this, but what about sex for yourself or sex with yourself?
Great sleep aid, but also has been proven over and over again mental health, mental well-being, stress, concentration, short-term memory, all sorts of problem-solving skills. All of this stuff is highly related to sexual activity, whether it's with a partner or with nobody else involved. I've worked with one woman who specializes in this type of research and training. And, she says that, most of the research bores out, I want to say it's either 50 or 60 years old, that you should actually have an orgasm every day, until about 50 or 60 years old. And then it tapers down to like every other day or something, is kind of the ideal thing for health. If you're looking for, the benefits of, whatever litany of benefits that sex has, which are more than I could articulate. It's not my area of expertise.
Well, we definitely like litanies of benefits.
Yes.
if that's got to be through sex, then so be it. That's probably why I've been able to perform such a high level for so long.
Yeah.
But, Kirk, so how damaging is it to be on a reverse cycle for 6 months? Or is that something that you can bounce back from quickly if you're able to go back into a good sleep hygiene routine?
No, I mean, the younger you are, the more resilient you are. And there's a lot of reasons for that. I mean, some of that's DNA degradation. Some of that's hormonal. Some of that's, just damaged connective tissue, inflammation, physiological and anatomical shifts. But really, like I said, there's probably nothing more damaging. If the military said, we're either going to, completely invert your circadian rhythms for 6 months, or we're going to feed you crayons for every meal for 6 months, you should probably go with the crayons.
Marines will definitely go for that.
Yeah. I mean, there's not much that breaks you worse than that. But the key is just to, is couple of things. One is to prepare for it the best that you can, and the other thing is to recover as quickly as you possibly can. It's kind of an interesting thing. I mean, over my career, I've run across a few things that were just so counterintuitive to me, and one of them is preparing for sleep deprivation, right? So if I told you, hey man, next month I'm going to starve you, right? That's part of the program. It's just, there's no way around it. That's just what we're going to do. Next month you're going to eat 500 calories a day, every day for a month. Well, what would you do this month?
I would go
You'd eat as much as you could, right? Like you'd stock up on calories. You're about to starve, right? But for some reason, if another physiological need, let's take the other way. Let's take sex and masturbation. It's like, all right, you're not going to be able to have any sort of sexual satisfaction for a month. What are you going to do? Like, I'm going to overdo it this month. Now, let's take sleep. If I told you I'm going to sleep deprive you next month, 85% of the people will tell me they're going to practice not sleeping so that they'll be ready to not sleep next month. Mm. Exactly the opposite, right? If you know you're going on a deployment, if you know you're going to be off schedule for a while, get all the sleep you can possibly get. When you're out, when you're out forward deployed and you know you're going to go out for 3 or 4 days and you have a couple of days, time beforehand. Of course, we know there's a billion things to do, but anytime you can get any sleep, get that sleep. And then when you come back from whatever that is, whether it's coming back from that one op or whether it's coming back from that deployment, the key is to pay that debt back as quickly as possible. It's just like credit card debt. The longer you let it linger, the more detrimental it is. The more minimal the payback you give, the longer it takes to pay it back. And it'll just destroy you. So the best thing that you can do is to pay that sleep debt back as quickly as you possibly can. So if you can come back and sleep for 12 hours a day for, 2 months, you'll probably pay back all your sleep debt and you'll probably be as healthy as you were before the whole thing started or pretty darn close to it. But if you come back and, now you got a staff job and boss expects you to be there early and stay there late and you're going to sleep, barely any more than you did when you were deployed, you're going to break down quick. And we've seen those guys we've all seen those guys.
Sure. That was going to be my next question. We just answered it. And that was going to be, can you catch up on sleep and can you actually pay it forward? But I think that was clearly articulated. Is 8 hours a good rule of thumb?
It's just that, though. It's a rule of thumb. So where that number comes from, it's not a single study, but the study that started it all was done by William Dement, a Stanford sleep researcher who's actually considered the grandfather of sleep medicine. He did something that he called a bunker trial. So he took a bunch of World War II bunkers, little pill boxes, and he put just a cot, and I don't even know if it was a toilet or if it was just, kind of like a 10-gallon paint can with a toilet lid on it or whatever, but there was nothing in there but a toilet and bed. And there were no windows, and it was cool, and it was dark. And he would lock these people in there for 14 hours a day and then let them out for 10 hours a day. And they could do whatever they wanted to. These were by and large college students because no one else has the time to do this or would do it for the amount of money he could pay. But what they found, and it's been done across a bunch of different cultures now and a bunch of different socioeconomics, cohorts and a bunch of different age groups. And it always turns out the same. When you first start doing this to people, you put people in a cold, dark room where they don't have any idea what time it is. There's no chance of stimulation. There's nothing for them to do except sleep or lay awake in a dark room in a bed. They sleep for about 12 and a half hours a day when they first start. Over the course of anywhere from 3 to 6 weeks, at the end, by the end of say 6 weeks, almost every single person in that group, and by almost, I mean, 99.7% of people will be sleeping 7.5 hours plus or minus half an hour. And they're doing various things when they leave for those 10 hours, but it's not like any of them are going out and running ultra marathons or something, or, you know, competing in powerlifting or something. So if you have a very vigorous job or a very vigorous, you know, life to where you're really putting out and doing some really tough things, outside of that sleep period, you probably need more than that 7.5 hours. But that's where the rule of thumb comes from. And it's ubiquitous. It comes out every time. To my knowledge, there has never been any one of these trials where they allow people to pay back their sleep debt and anybody comes back anything significantly different than that. Or, you know, if it do, it's maybe 1 out of 1,000 or 1 out of 10,000 people that are coming back, you know, with a statistical, significant change from that 7.5 hour to plus or minus half an hour.
That's fascinating. I know everybody is an individual case, but is there any recommendations you would have or give for supplementation prior to sleep or to aid sleep?
Well, of course, you know, I'm biased in that I created a sleep supplement specifically to get SEALs off of their sleep drugs, which is,
let's hear all about it.
Yeah. So that was really, that was something that just came about once I started studying sleep. I'm like, well, damn, these sleep drugs really seem like they're not doing, anybody any favors, and they're not. And by sleep aids, I said sleep drugs, but, you know, sleep aids, we'll call them. I'm talking about over the counters, and I'm talking about prescription, and I'm talking about alcohol as a sleep aid as well, which is a common sleep aid. And what it does is it disrupts what we call the sleep architecture. So when you sleep, we expect you to have very predictable brainwave patterns. And those brainwave patterns correlate with breathing patterns and pulse and heart rate variability and movement. And when we add all this stuff together, we create something that's called a hypnogram. And it's this really graphic, you know, very easily understandable graphic representation of what stage of sleep are you in and for how long. When you take sleep drugs, sleep aids, it messes with that sleep architecture. Well, you know, one of the things I ask in my lectures, I do it, you know, partly for fun, but, you know, partly to make the point of how sort of surprising it is. You know, most people can't define sleep. Like if I said, you know, tell me what sleep is, 90% of the people just kind of flounder, don't really know. Interestingly, you know, doctors who specialize in sleep don't even all agree what sleep is. But we all have an experiential sense of what it means to be asleep. So we know what it feels like to be asleep, and we know when we're asleep and when we're not asleep, but we can't necessarily define it. So, you know, the important aspect of all of that is that when you're talking about sleep drugs, sleep aids, sleep supplements, if they're distorting that sleep architecture and it's not looking like what we know, and it doesn't have to be ideal, but, you know, there is an idealized version. It's a cartoon version, so it's not exact, but there is an idealized version of what sleep stages should look like. And if what you're using to help you go to sleep changes that and it makes it not look like that version, then you're not really getting the benefits of sleep. Whether or not you agree to the definition of sleep or not, we can say, well, the normal things that happen during normal people's sleep is not happening with you, or this graph would look the same as everybody else's graph. So as an example, you know, when I had all these SEALs who had all these problems that I couldn't understand, and I started learning about sleep and I wondered how much sleep was impacting it. And, you know, one of the things that people overlook is, you know, something as simple as the hormones. You know, like I wanted to fix their hormones right away, but Navy wasn't going to let me fix their hormones because that was taboo. But then I learned, well, actually all their sex hormones are made during, you know, stages 4, 3 and 4 of sleep. That's when their growth hormone is made. That's when their testosterone is made. That's when their immune system is functioning at its highest. That's when they're repairing all of their damaged tissues. So that's the really important part. And I would send these guys in to get a sleep study. on their Ambien or their, you know, Xanax or their alcohol or their, you know, over-the-counter sleep aid, which is usually, you know, some, you know, Benadryl, essentially, diphenhydramine. They would come back with 99% stage two sleep. Well, what's stage two sleep? Stage two sleep is what we call a transitory stage, right? So we don't really think stage two does anything except set you up for the next phase. So you're really not getting any sleep. You're really unconscious. It looks a lot more like if somebody gets in a motorcycle wreck and ends up in a coma, or somebody gets knocked unconscious and you put electrodes on their brain. That's what that looks like. You know, that's what this supposed sleep is actually looking like. So they're not getting the benefits of sleep. Now, how much of the benefits are they not getting? I can't tell you that, right? I mean, that's going to vary from person to person, but we can tell you that the reason that they're sleeping is to do lots of things. There's lots of things that are supposed to be repairing, lots of things that are supposed to be shifting, lots of things that are supposed to be going away, lots of things that are supposed to be building up, and those things just aren't happening, so you really aren't sleeping. So it's really no different than eating, you know, food that your body isn't designed to digest and being surprised that your nutritional state isn't all that great.
Well, when you're talking about hormones, and I know that insulin is antagonistic to certain hormonal production, would it make sense to try to go to sleep in a low insulin state?
No, what makes sense is just to have really good insulin sensitivity. And that's done by controlling diet. That's done by exercising frequently, but it's also done by getting regular quality sleep. One of the interesting things that most people don't realize is that if you deprive yourself of 2 hours of sleep, so instead of getting 8 hours of sleep, you sleep 6 hours, the next day your insulin sensitivity in many of your tissues is decreased by about 30%. Your testosterone levels are decreased by about 30%. Your inflammatory markers are raised by about 30%. Your thyroid function is
diabetes,
decreased.
Heart disease.
Yeah, so if you're kind of like a metabolically broken average Joe, 40-something-year-old dude who, you know, has not really stayed in great shape and, you know, hasn't totally destroyed himself, but, you know, you're kind of on the edge, you're essentially probably waking up as a diabetic. If you're, if you're a little healthier, you're probably waking up as a pre-diabetic or sort of a metabolic syndrome type health level. And if you're diabetic, you're waking up sort of in diabetic crisis, you know, and that's just one hormone we're talking about. Right. But, you know, again, like you take away those 2 hours of sleep, it's not just the hormones. I mean, it is the hormones, but there's so many hormones involved. I mean, you have your appetite, say for the next day, that's completely derived by how well you sleep. That, you know, there's a neuroregulation of appetite. It's your brain that's telling you whether or not you're hungry. It's not your muscles. It's not your liver. It's not your heart. It's your brain. And we know if we take 2 hours of sleep away from you, your insulin sensitivity is lower, which means what? You need more glucose. Your body's going to crave glucose. But your body also perceives this rapid change in blood glucose level and insulin sensitivity as possible famine, so you want to eat a bunch of fat as well. You know, enter, you know, freaking donuts, because they're what? High in fat and high in sugar. And of course, you're tired. Your neurochemistry is all screwed up. You haven't gotten rid of all the adenosine. You have lots of neurotoxins. So what do we do about that? Well, we try to block the adenosine by putting some caffeine in there and making ourselves more awake. You know, so, you know, we try to do all these compensatory things, but, you know, your sex drive is lowered. Your immune system is lowered. Your ability to communicate, your ability to be empathic, you know, to understand emotions, to express your own emotions accurately, to categorize emotional events, to remember things, you know, to be able to, you know, formulate new ideas with new information that you've learned, to, you know, predict the most likely consequence of an action that you take right now. All of that stuff is altered. Every single one of those things is altered by a single night of short sleep. And, you know, there's been a lot of work done for decades where they try to compare, well, how bad is the performance, right? Well, let's compare it to blood alcohol level. So when somebody's really drunk, really stupid drunk, we know they aren't performing well and just about any respect we, you know, about anything we'd ever measure ourselves in, they're not performing well. So what does it take to be functionally drunk? Sleep deprivation wise? Well, being awake for 17 hours in a row, not right. That's not a huge deal, right? Lots of people are awake for 17 hours in a row, but being awake for 17 hours in a row and driving home at the end of those 17 hours, you perform on par with somebody with a blood alcohol level of 0.05. Okay. That's, you know, in most countries, that's not legally drunk. Like, I don't know why it's called legally drunk. It should be called illegally drunk, but you know what I mean? It's not, you know, you're not so impaired that you're not allowed to be driving, but you get up to 24 hours and you perform on par with somebody with a blood alcohol level of 0.08 to 0.1. Now, I can tell you when I was working in hospitals and when I was working as a SEAL, I can't even tell you the number of times I drove home after being awake for 36 hours straight or 48 hours straight or something ridiculous like that. And then, you know, 48 hours, being awake for 48 hours is ridiculous. It's like it's on par with a blood alcohol level of like 0.2. So, I mean, you're just a hot mess. You can't do anything. So, you know, people's arguments and retorts is, well, I don't stay up for 24 hours. I don't stay up for 48 hours. You know, that, so it doesn't apply to me. But guess what? How many people sleep 6 hours a night instead of 8 hours a night? The answer is 83% of America, roughly, right? If you sleep 6 hours a night for 11 consecutive nights, you perform exactly as though you haven't slept for 24 hours. You do that for 22 days in a row, you perform exactly as though you haven't slept for 48 hours. So the first response I get to that is bullshit, because I've been sleeping 6 hours a night for this many years and I'm not performing as though I haven't slept for 48 hours. But the interesting thing is that bunker trial I told you about, where we sleep adapt people, figure out, you know, how much sleep they need. And another thing that we added on to that test after, you know, several years is after we sleep adapted people, we tested them in anything you want to test them in, playing the piano, typing with their left hand, lifting heavy weights, endurance activities, problem solving, driving cars, doesn't matter. We tested them, gave them a baseline test after they were sleep adapted. Then we took away 2 hours of sleep. Come back, test them the next morning. How do you think you did? They'd say, I didn't do as well. I was tired. Day two, same thing happens. Day three, maybe same thing happens. But day four, every single one of them say, I'm completely adapted to this new schedule. I did as well as I've ever done. And you can show them the data. It's like, nope, you did worse. Here's the data right here. It shows that you did worse. And they'll argue with they'll argue with the researchers and tell them they got it wrong, that they know they did as well. And it's, you know, I use the metaphor a lot of my talks about, you know, people drinking. All right. A guy goes to a bar, has a beer, no big deal. He has two beers. He's like, maybe I better wait a while before I drive home. He has three beers. Maybe I shouldn't drive home. Four beers. Like, I'm fine. I can go. You know, it's the same. You lose that introspection. It's the same type of thing. So that's why people don't buy it when you tell them how bad their performance is. And you see all these 30-day challenges all over the world, you know, 30-day sugar challenge, 30-day vegetable challenge, 30-day meat challenge, I don't know, all sorts of dietary exercise challenges, 30 days, this and that. I ask people for a week, make sleep your number one priority for a week, your number one priority, just 8 hours of sleep every night for 1 week. That's your number one priority. Make it your priority. Make it happen. At the end of that week, if you don't feel any better, you can say that I'm a quack and you'll never have to listen to anything I ever say again. So far, nobody has ever done that and come back and said, I've feel better with less. They all come back saying, man, I feel fantastic. I cannot believe how screwed up I was. I thought I was feeling normal. It's like trying to convince a drunk person they're drunk. The drunk person will never believe they're drunk. The next day they'll believe they're drunk. So that's what we're doing, right? We're giving them 7 days of good sleep. So now they're completely sober and they go, man, I was really drunk.
Kirk, I want to hear about your personal sleep hygiene routine. And do you have a wake up hygiene routine? And then, you know, what benefits have you noticed in your life that you can speak on once you invoke these?
Well, I would love to say that, you know, I was super clever and I figured all this out for myself and did all sorts of amazing things for my own performance. But I was probably helping SEALs sleep better for, you know, get off of sleep drugs and alcohol and so forth and sleep better. I was probably doing that for a year before I'd thought, maybe I should try this on myself and see if it makes a difference for me. I chose two professions that didn't value sleep, right? I mean, special forces doesn't value sleep. And then, you know, medicine doesn't value sleep. I mean, they're both just that same type of mentality. You just beat your head against the wall harder, keep running harder, and you'll eventually break through. But I mean, I can tell you that I was a basket case. I didn't realize I was a basket case. I just thought, you know, I wasn't quite as good as I used to be. But you know, I just turned 47, I don't know, 4 months ago or something like that. I can tell you I'm in way better physical shape and cognitive shape right now at 47 than I was at 37. And it's 100% because of sleep. I haven't changed my diet much. The only thing I've really changed about my fitness routine is I exercise a hell of a lot less than I used to, just because I was completely overdoing it. But it's primarily a sleep issue. I mean, I had psoriasis. I was losing my hair. I was anxious as hell. I mean, my cell phone would ring and I would like immediately panic that, I don't know, freaking the president was calling to kick me out of the military or something to, you know, something to happened tragic with one of my children or something. And why? Because my cell phone rang. Like no rational thought to it whatsoever. I was moody. My body composition sucked. My performance in every sport that I wanted to do sucked. And like I said, I mean, I didn't put it together for myself. I put it together once I started seeing these great changes in these team guys' lives and what they were coming back and telling me. I mean, it just really seemed hyperbolic to me. It just seemed ridiculous. I'm like, come on. Like, I thought they were, you know, just trying to make me feel good. You know, I'm like, come on. Like, really? I mean, yeah. You know, you're 45 years old and you're really PRing with, you know, the same sport you've been doing for 20 years. And I'm like, yeah, man, I really am. And, so I started applying it to myself. But like I said, I mean, there's no limit to what it does for you. I mean, if you're looking for performance optimization, you can put butter in your coffee and order drugs off the internet and do all that other kind of crazy biohacking crap if you want to. But, you know, the body you're living in is about 200,000 years old and it took millions of years to evolve. Best, you know, odds are the smartest keeper of the information and the smartest operator for the system is the system, you know, is what's built into the system. And, you know, what turns out to be true is that sleeping, how you evolved to sleep and exercising the way you evolved to exercise and keeping a diet that's somewhat close to how you evolved to eat, keeping a stress level that's fairly well correlated to sort of the way we evolve. Those are your biggest performance enhancing tools right there. I'm not completely poo-pooing on all of the, you know, different biohacking techniques and devices and gadgets and, you know, wearables and metrics and, you know, things to improve yourself. I'm all for that stuff, but, you know, that stuff is the icing on the cake. That's, you know, that's the 2-3% difference at the end. It's the lifestyle that makes all the difference. And so for me, it's nothing fancy. I mean, I do everything I can. I'm actually a 9-hour a night guy. I've just found that to be true through lots of different sort of metrics of my own and studying myself. I'd prefer if I were a 7-hour guy, that'd be easier for my life. You know, I'd have more daylight to get stuff done. But, you know, I'm a 9-hour guy night and I do what I have to do to get that time. And, You know, it's all the same sleep hygiene that everybody else talks about. There's no magic to it. You decrease the photo period. You decrease the blue light in your eyes, you know, 3 to 4 hours before you go to sleep. You know, that sleep supplement that I derived to help get seals off sleep drugs, there's nothing in there except what ordinarily gets concentrated in your brain from the time the sun goes down until the time you go to sleep is about a 3 hour period. It takes for all these nutrients to concentrate in your brain and drive you to sleep. And so I take my sleep supplement that kind of condenses that 3 hours down to about 30 minutes. And it, you know, helps compress all that. And like I said, decrease the stimulation to my brain, decrease the light in my eyes. Get myself on a schedule, you know, stick to it. It's, you know, my sleep schedule is just as important as my workout schedule. It's just as important as my work schedule. It's just as important as my tax schedule, as everything else. I mean, it's a non-negotiable aspect of my life. And you know,
if you miss an hour or two, do you have like a set day where you'll catch up or anything like that?
No, my advice is now and always has been that if you miss any sleep, the ideal thing is to pay that sleep debt back as fast as you can. If I can pay it back with a 2 hour nap that same day, I'll do it that day. If I can't catch up until the weekend, then I'll catch up on the weekend.
Now, I've used the Sleep Remedy products, and I highly recommend it to anybody out there that's listening and thinking, you know, or wondering, is this for me? It's a phenomenal product. Kirk, I know you had a book coming out talking about some of the stuff that we just talked about. Can you speak a little bit to the audience about your book, when it's out, and where they can find it?
Yeah, the book's on – you can pre-order the book on Amazon right now. The book is basically a little deeper level of everything we just talked about. It starts out with just a little bit about the basics of sleep physiology. You know, what we evolved to do during sleep, why we do it, what it takes to get good sleep, and then I just kind of break it down into performance metrics. What I found kind of surprising, you know, probably only surprising because I'm a doctor, my whole education system was around disease and disease prevention and disease mm-hmm. mitigation and disease management. And so I tried to talk a lot about that. And it's true, you know, that sleep does increase your risk of cardiovascular disease and stroke and cancer. It's actually classified as a type 2A carcinogen by the World Health Organization. We know it increases your risk for psychotic diseases and depression and all sorts of stuff. And, you know, diabetes and obesity and all this stuff. But at the end of the day, people just don't really seem to care that much about the disease. You know, that's way down the road. So the book just has a high emphasis on how sleeping well improves your performance, and, you know, how to game that system. So of course, you know, my foundation is lifestyle. And that's sleep, nutrition, exercise, stress control, mindset, you know, all of the stuff that goes into just lifestyle management. But then after that, there's mitigating techniques, right? There's supplements, there's nutritional supplements, there's, you know, little gadgets you can use that'll help, put light in your eyes early in the day to help shift your circadian rhythm. There's things you can do to, you know, block, you know, to help you go to sleep at night. You know, if noise is an issue for you, or if, you know, darkness or coolness, and, you know, all of those types of devices and gadgets, you know, they're all game. You know, they're all part of the game, and they're all things you can use to enhance performance. But, you know, if you wanted to compete in Tour de France, you don't go, you know, if you're 40 pounds overweight, the first step isn't to go buy a $50,000 bicycle. It's to lose 40 pounds and then start getting better and better bikes and fine tuning, that type of stuff. So that's kind of the approach I take on it. And I just break down performance into, you know, like cognitive and physical and emotional and talk through how all that stuff works.
Kirk, where can people find you on the internet and your product and your website? And are you on Twitter or any of the social media?
Yeah, I'm on all the social media platforms. I think, you know, because I did a lot of the stuff myself, which was foolish. I'm an IT moron. I should have never done any of it myself.
Me too.
So, I mean, some of my handles are Doc Parsley and some of them are Kirk Parsley, whatever. The easiest thing is just to go to my site. It's docparsley.com. It's DOC. And then there's like the herb parsley, docparsley.com. And that has my, you know, that has my Twitter on it, my Instagram and my Facebook and my LinkedIn and all that stuff. You can get to it from there. Or you can, you know, search out for me, either Kirk Parsley or Doc Parsley on all those platforms.
Awesome. Awesome. Andrew, anything else?
No, it's been very enlightening. I just wanted to get Doc Parsley on because he's so knowledgeable in this area. And I know what he was talking about as far as, you know, the SEALs having those problems are pretty ubiquitous across the board in the military. Special operations arena or not, you know. So we just wanted to get you on, Kirk, and deliver this information so they could have it, you know. And you've been doing it for a while, but now it's we got it up and, you know, it's out there forever.
And I can tell you I'm definitely going to be sleeping 8 hours a night for the next week at least. And I'll definitely report back to you on how I feel.
I want to hear it, man. I want to hear it. And 100%. If it's amazing, you got to put it on the podcast. You got to throw it out there and let everybody know.
Oh, dude, I'll scream it from the mountaintops. I'll be all over the place doing it. So.
I think secretly, Kirk, I just wanted to have you on here because I was ready to put Chris's head through the door because he refuses to give up on this. I'm going to bed at 11 and getting up at 4 bullshit. And thank you. Maybe we can at least get him to try a week.
All right, man. Sounds great.
Definitely. Well, I want to thank everybody out there for listening to this. This is one of the most enlightening podcasts I've had the pleasure of doing. And one of the things that I think this is going to lead to is a significant change for a lot of people's lives. And it's amazing how much the little things that we don't think about, you know, your sleep can really affect you in every single way. And I'll definitely be reporting back my results. And I commit to all of you and to Doc Parsley and to Andrew that I'm going to sleep for 8 hours for the next 7 nights at least.
Well, and again, in the military, what made anybody good was mastering the fundamentals, the basics, not some, you know, G'd up optics or anything else. Become a master of the iron sights. Well, the same thing in your own life. Master the basics of sleep. Master the basics of diet, nutrition, and then start looking at what those benefits are. But we can't be jumping, like Doc said, to go buy a, you know, a crazy expensive bike and be 40 pounds overweight. So just reiterating, master the basics and life will improve. And this is a prime example.
And realize that it's part of you being the best version of yourself and living your best life.
So, absolutely.
Awesome. And with that, ladies, gentlemen, everybody out there, and a big thank you to Doc Parsley for coming on. We will talk to you next time.
What's going on, guys? I hope you enjoyed that episode with Dr. Kirk Parsley. I want to let you know about a few other things going on at Warrior Soul. As you know, we sell clothing, but we also sell fitness knowledge products. Now, you hear a lot about things like ketosis and the paleo diet and different nutrition modalities. Well, what we've been doing now, because we see there's a lot of information going around out in the internet, we want to make sure that you're getting good information, the very best information. And so what we've done is we've started putting together publications and fitness courses and knowledge products that you can use to build your best life. Right now, we are selling a awesome package that contains the Warrior Soul Keto Camp course and the Warrior Soul Fitness Foundations course. Now, both of these courses are awesome. The Fitness Foundation course includes everything you need to know about optimizing your digestion, optimizing your sleep, optimizing your hormones, and building your own diet, your own nutrition plan, and your own training plan. Warrior Soul Keto Camp goes a little bit more into depth on ketosis, and we show you how to get through keto adaptation, how to fat adapt so that your body is burning fat for fuel rather than glucose. It gives you lasting energy, and it really helps to lean you out and to enhance your performance because you're not dependent on glucose, which goes up and down in your bloodstream. You've got a steady source of fuel throughout the day. So we wanted to get these courses out there, and we're putting out them out there extremely inexpensively. They're only $47.97. In a lot of places, these courses would cost upwards of $500, $600. So definitely get over to www.warriorsoulketocamp.com, and you'll get access to these amazing courses and so much more. Beyond that, we also put together an awesome private mastermind that, again, costs very little. It's only $7.97 a month, and we're giving it away for 30 days for free. That's your first 30 days in this thing for free, where you're going to get free workouts every single day, new recipes every single week, and guidance from our fitness team. It's called the Warrior Soul Goji. And basically, the way it runs is we post up new workouts every single day that you're going to be able to do. We post both a gym workout and a home fitness routine. So definitely check that out. Like I said, it's only $7.97 a month. Really inexpensive. And we're giving it away for the first 30 days for free with no obligations to pay whatsoever. So if you want to check that out, just head over to our main website at www.warriorsoulagoji, that's AGOGE.com, and you'll be able to do so. So again, I hope you enjoyed this episode. Make sure that you check out the show notes if you're interested in Dr. Parsley's sleep remedy, and definitely check out my brother Andrew's new book, Tales from the Blast Factory. If you've served in the military ever, Not just in the past 10 years, but ever, and you haven't felt right, you need to read this book. Traumatic brain injury is more ubiquitous than we actually think it is. And we're not only talking about the problem, we're also talking about potential solutions that you can implement in your life and advocating for potential solutions for the U.S. government to implement so that we begin to actually protect our service members rather than just throwing them out to the wind. Hope you have an amazing week, and we will be back to you soon with another great episode. We got Brian McKenzie, the endurance expert, coming up this week. Talk to y'all soon. Peace.